Nick DeGiglio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about things that are turning 50 this year in 2019 so we can all feel old. Much more. Right now, though, we want to do the Monday morning movie reviews. You know, Jim Leskowski is under the weather, and he will not be joining us as he is taking over for Colin Suter. But Jim is sick this week, so it's just going to be me and Eric taking care of the movies. But we will review all the new movies, and that's what we do every Monday morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. And stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. I got a bunch of movies to talk about this week. And like I said, Jim's under the weather, but Eric is with us. And here is Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hey, man.
All right. So let's get started.
Okay.
Why don't you start with Angel?
Okay. Angel or The Angel or El Angel. It's a story of a real-life serial killer, young boy who kind of started off. It's an Argentinian film, Argentinian serial killer by the name of Carlos Roberto Puig, and he was a teenager in Argentina, and he kind of started off just kind of doing petty crimes. A friend of his at school had a father who was basically kind of a career criminal, and did some jobs for him, and started to develop a greater taste for whatever he could get away with. And all of a sudden, robberies and petty thievery kind of led into murders and whatever he could cover up with that. Based on a true story, we've seen, it's not the first movie we're going to be talking about tonight about a serial killer. These movies can tend to be, kind of interesting if you don't know the history of these of this guy. But there's really not a whole lot interesting about him. It's a competently made movie and all, but the character himself is not particularly that interesting. He's just another kind of jerky kid who, he's got a taste for something. The crimes themselves are not particularly that outrageous or interesting, and it's just kind of just delves into kind of typical biopic tropes and things, eventually just, leading up to, where it's all headed and, how this guy eventually got caught. It's a watchable film, but not a particularly memorable one.
Okay. And it is available on Netflix if people are interested in seeing that one. All right, cool. All right. Well, why don't we just move on to the house that Jack built since
we
started with serial killers. Tell us about the house that Jack built.
Yeah, well, this is the latest from your favorite filmmaker, Lars von Trier.
Yeah.
And this movie, people might remember, premiered to some a lot of controversy at Cannes last year. It's the story of Matt Dillon plays a guy just named Jack, who, as the film begins, is telling his story to someone. We hear the off screen. It's sort of narrated. He's talking to someone named Verge, and he's basically telling a story about how he became a serial killer. And it all began with picking up a woman played by Uma Thurman, who in a scene that really kind of bugged me from the outset, he picks her up because she has a car problem, and gives her kind of the standard "don't worry, I'm not a serial killer" line, and then she proceeds for the next 5 to 10 minutes to basically say all the things he's doing wrong if he was a serial killer. And she becomes such a shrew that he hits her in the face with a tire jack and kills her, and thus beginning his illustrious road down multiple murders, as we see each incident, how it comes to fruition, a lot of it done with a lot of black humor. It verges between black humor and some really disgusting, disturbing things. you know, one after the other, all also punctuated by him telling the story to this Verge character, and them debating about whether or not what he's doing can actually be construed as art. And this leads to a lot of philosophical discussions that weaves in old film clips, including many from von Trier's own filmography himself, whether or not, you know, exactly, you know, can all these things be tied into what, you know, movies teach us, we know exactly who's feeding the beast kind of here. And that stuff gets real tiresome really, really quickly. As I started to allude to with Angel, you know, movies about serial killers, you know, can be one of, you know, usually one of two things. They usually can be very disturbing, or they can sometimes be kind of, you know, darkly humorous, kind of funny in a way, in a disturbing kind of way. But this movie can't really decide whether it wants to be Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer or American Psycho, and just kind of blends those two things together, and it makes for a very frustrating, sometimes sickening experience. I mean, there are murders that he commits along the way, particularly the one involving Siobhan Fallon, that is rather humorous. There are others involving, one involving Riley Keough, that is quite just awful to think about, and even one more so right in the middle of the film involving a mother and her two children. That's really awful. So, I mean, Matt Dillon is, I think, quite good in the film. You know, it's certainly one thing that can get you through a lot of the more disturbing bits in the film. Not that this is the first time we've seen him play a serial killer. I kept thinking of A Kiss Before Dying many, many times throughout the film. Does lead to a final 15 minutes that, even though you should be able to guess exactly who he's been talking through this entire film, the name also kind of gives it away if you're up on that sort of thing. The last 15 minutes of the movie are particularly kind of engrossing and really striking to behold. I almost wish that the entire film was set in this location, because the visuals of this of the climax of the film are really pretty tremendous. So it's kind of a mixed bag for me. I don't hate the film. I can't really quite recommend it. There are portions of it that I think are amusing, and, you know, some of it was very well done. Dillon is very good, but overall, I can't quite give it my full endorsement.
Okay. And it is 2.5 hours long.
That too.
Yeah.
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 And I didn't see the unrated cut either.
Okay. Did he make changes? Did von Trier make changes after the?
Well, there was one that played at the Music Box, like at the end of December. That was like the full unrated cut.
Mm-hmm.
That was the can cut, and then there was one that was actually cut down for an R rating, I guess.
Oh, okay.
That's the one that I saw.
Okay, and it's still 2.5 hours. The cut you saw,
pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
All right, I've grown real tired of Lars von Trier. His movies now have just become like endurance tests, you know. And I haven't seen this, and I don't really plan on seeing it either. But despite the fact that I really like Matt Dillon a lot, and
mm-hmm.
and I would imagine that he's probably very good in this because he can play this kind of role. But I've got no patience for von Trier at this point.
What was that? I mean, you liked Melancholia.
Yeah,
though,
I did.
You?
Yes, I did. I liked that. The Nymphomaniac movies, those were terrible.
Yeah, well, that
the,
was yeah.
The Willem Dafoe and the other woman just like I didn't even
Antichrist.
Remember.
Christ.
I mean, geez. I mean, what are we doing here?
This is better than both of those.
Okay.
I would say, but the stuff, I mean, knowing you, you'd probably enjoy, you know, at least half of the murder scenes,
uh-huh.
But the pontificating about the art of it all. Well, and Von Trier actually showing scenes from Melancholia and, like, Breaking the Waves and things like that.
Yeah.
And just kind of like, oh, God.
Well,
who do you think you are?
No, that, I mean, the trailer was enough to, you know, like, I saw the trailer for this, and there was, like, a little sort of, I saw the trailer, and then I was looking around online, and there was, like, a little featurette on it. And that was all. That was pretty much. I got the whole gist of it. You know, just I got the whole gist of it just from that. So
yeah.
All right. Now, and that's the house that Jack built, which is out right now. All right. Well, why don't I tell you about The Dog's Way Home? Since
please do.
We can go from one extreme to the other.
Yeah.
A Dog's Way Home is the latest movie with somebody doing the voiceover of a dog and a dog going home. Now we've seen, you know, there's a million of these things.
There are
that have been made over the years.
Mm-hmm.
What's the Incredible Journey?
Homeward Bound.
Yeah. Those are all. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Homeward Bound is that's probably the quintessential one. You know what I mean?
Right.
The Homeward Bound, because you've got three animals, right? There were three, right? In Homeward Bound.
Yes.
Yeah, and they all had they all provided voiceovers, and they all tried to make their way home. And it's not this is not a new thing. I mean, this has been done a million times. Now, my mom really wanted to see this movie. That's why we went. That's why we went on Saturday. My mom's like, I really want to see it. I want to see it. And I'm like, oh God. So essentially, what happens is this guy first of all, you're introduced to the dog first. The dog was raised by a bunch of cats that lived in a they live in this decrepit sort of like building where all the cats are there, and this dog is raised by these cats, and then animal control comes to try and grab all the cats and get rid of the cats, and all of a sudden, this guy who's been feeding the cat, this guy who lives across the street with his mother, played by Ashley Judd, he is feeding the cats and taking care of the cats. His name is Lucas in the movie, and the actor's name is Jonah Howard King. And he's living with his mother, played by Ashley Judd. They live across the street from the dilapidated house, and he takes care of these cats, these stray cats. When the evil guy who owns the building decides that they're just going to gut the building and kill all the cats, he wants to stop this guy from doing that, but he falls in love with the dog. The dog runs up to him immediately and jumps into his arms. And the dog is voiced by Bryce Dallas Howard. So that's the voice that you hear for the dog throughout the movie. Talks about how much she loves, I love Lucas. And so then the dog is taken away from Lucas, and because of the whole building thing, and there's, for some reason, I'm not really sure why, but pit bulls, I guess, are illegal in Denver, according to this movie.
They have some illegality somewhere.
Yeah.
So I think that's part possible.
So this dog is a pit bull, so they take him away from Lucas, so he's, they take the dog away from him, and they put the dog away, and then the dog escapes, gets out, and is going to go across the country to get back to Lucas. So that's the adventure. Now, hang on, Eric. I know you're waiting on bated breath to find out what happens.
I am.
But why don't you hang on for a second? We're going to take a break. We got the news. When we come back, I'll let you know how the whole thing turns out. I mean, I don't know. You know, the title of the movie is A Dog's Way Home, so you might be able to figure it out. All right, anyway, we'll take a break for the news here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios. We are here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Our friend Jim Leskowski is ill this morning, so he will not be joining us for the movie reviews. So Eric Childress and I are taking care of those. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. We're going to be talking about 50 things that turn 50 this year so that we can all feel old and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Eric Childress is with us. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, I was telling you about A Dog's Way Home before the break. And like I said, this is nothing new. The adventure of a dog away from his master, trying to get home, and this dog named Bella is voiced by Bryce Dallas Howard. And along the way, the dog has all kinds of adventures, which you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
Meets like a cougar in the middle of the wild, and they hang out together. And they're being chased by wolves, has all kinds of adventures on how to eat, And how is this dog going to eat? He runs around with a bunch of with a pack of other dogs, learning lessons, and it's all done, you know, with Bryce Dallas Howard being relatively annoying as the dog's voice. Now, I will say this. Charles Martin Smith directed this movie. And for those people, I mean, Charles Martin Smith, a lot of people know as an actor. He was in American Graffiti. He was in Never Cry Wolf. He was in Starman. And he is also a director. And he's directed several movies, many of which are about animals. I didn't realize until I looked at his filmography that that's kind of his specialty now. Is like doing these movies, is doing movies about animals and stuff. Like Dolphin Tale, he did the two Dolphin Tale movies. He did he's done a bunch of those.
Air Bud.
Air Bud.
Yeah,
that's right. He directed Air Bud. And this seems to be his thing. He's worked a lot. You know, he's directed a lot of television and a lot of episodes of TV and things like that. This seems to be, when he's making movies, this seems to be the thing he does now. And there are wolves in this movie, which I thought was kind of cool because, you know, he was in Never Cry Wolf, which is a movie that I adore. I love Never Cry Wolf. I think it's such a great movie, and I think he's terrific in it. He was also in The Untouchables. I keep forgetting he's in
The
Untouchables too. So he's all the way around. Now, I will say this: it's a well made movie. This is a very specific kind of movie. It's a kids movie. It's for kids, and the place was packed. By the way, when we went on Saturday, theater was packed. On a really crappy day, too, because we went out, it was Saturday afternoon when we went, and that was when it was like, you know, the wind was blowing at about 900 miles an hour, and it was snowing. It was really nasty, but the place was packed. So it's a well-made movie, and it hits all the right buttons. If you like these sort of, you know, these kind of adventure, these kids' adventure movies with animals, you know, having adventures, this hits all the right notes, and it does it well. And I cried at the end, because I'm just a wuss. And it's not by any stretch of the imagination a particularly a great movie. Like I said, Bryce Dallas Howard's voiceover gets a little bit shrill at times, and it's a little bit annoying. The dog is adorable, or whatever, how many dogs they used for this movie. Is really adorable, and like I said, it hits all the right notes, and the kids in the theater were all, you know, transfixed by it, and there were moments in the movie where you go, oh no, you know, you get scared for the dog, and it all works. The whole relationship between the dog and the cougar is corny and ridiculous, and according to this movie, the dog is away for 2.5 years, so this goes on for 2.5 years.
Oh my lord.
It goes on for 2.5 years. And I will say this, once the movie jumps into the dog's point of view, it does not stray from that. So, like, you never see, you know, the kid Lucas being upset that his dog is gone. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like, it is, once the dog is, you know, is on its own, it's all from the dog's point of view, and you don't see the whole family again until, well, maybe at the end when they might be reunited. So it's all told from the dog's point of view. So in that regard, you know, it works. Now, as a kids' movie, it's really entertaining. And like I said, the kids in the theater, it was packed with kids when we saw it. The kids in the theater really loved it. They all sort of like moaned when they were supposed to, and they clapped when they were supposed to, and, you know, you could tell that they were engrossed and that they really liked the dog, and the dog again is adorable. And so, you know, this is a PG rated, perfectly suited movie for kids, and it hits all the right notes. And again, this is a movie that's been made 9,000 times before, and it'll probably be made 9,000 more times, and they'll probably all be directed by Charles Martin Smith,
right?
Because that seems to be his thing, But I'm recommending it for, you know, I mean, it, like I said, everything that it sets out to do, it achieves. So, I mean, it's a entertaining kids movie. My mom loved it, and it was exactly what, you know, we expected it to be. It was, you know, adventures with animals, and then you cry at the end. That's that's pretty much what it is. So, I'm recommending it. So that's a Dog's Way Home, and it's perfect for families and kids and all that stuff. So there you go. Okay, Eric, why don't you tell us about Replicas?
Oh boy. Okay. Well, this is a new science fiction film starring Keanu Reeves as a bio-engineer, scientist guy that is working on perfecting putting human consciousness into robots. I don't want to get too much into the jargon of this movie. Let's just say he wants to put human consciousness into robots. Okay, as the movie begins, we see that is problematic. Robots don't respond, or human consciousness doesn't respond well when they realize that they're not in their human body. Keanu Reeves also has a family. His wife is played by Alice Eve, and they have a number of young children. And during a rainy drive one night, well, none of them make it. There's a big crash, none of them make it. And in sort of classic 1950s sci-fi style, he wants to basically bring them back. His partner, played by Thomas Middleditch, he also has some expert in cloning. So they decide to basically merge their technologies and bring the family back. But when you bring the family back in their actual bodies and stuff, and people are aware that they're dead, you kind of have to hide them off from the public. So that's part of the movie. There's also the later part of the movie of them, or at least the wife discovering that they might not be who they think they are, hilarity ensues. And I do mean hilarity, because it's a really stupid movie. Just the overview of it. But it's also a film like, you go into this movie and you hear that plot description. You know, I'm thinking that eventually, like the opening scene, things are just going to go bad. When people play God in movies, it usually tends to go bad for them. And the whole time I'm watching this movie, at least, until this movie sort of revealed itself to where I think it was going, I kept thinking that this movie's going to turn into Godsend, or, that stupid Robert De Niro, Greg Kinnear movie from years ago.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really go there. Actually, like the villain of this movie, is not really Keanu Reeves, but the company that he works for. And I didn't expect, a science fiction movie about resurrection and cloning, and, mad scientists to devolve into like proprietary law involving the company that they, that all of a sudden his family are like, products of theirs, and that becomes like the chief conflict in the movie. This is just of avoidable science fiction at all costs. It's not fun in any way. It offers nothing to any type of discussion that you would hope in even a half-witted science fiction concept like this. It's just dumb and bad and should have gone. I'm surprised it didn't go straight to video, frankly. I mean, this movie doesn't really have any place to be in theaters.
Yeah, I thought it was going to go straight to video. I saw a trailer for this thing a long time ago, and just assumed that it would go straight to VOD. I just didn't think we'd get a theatrical release. But Byron Allen. We can thank Byron Allen.
Yeah,
and his Entertainment Village or whatever the hell.
I wish it was called Entertainment Village.
Entertainment Studios got a hold of this thing and got it a release, and a big release. It's in a bunch of theaters, and it's got a lot of press. They took out a lot of ads for this movie, and this is Z-grade sci-fi. I mean, this is...
Yes.
And I love... You know how much I love Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
But, man, I mean, this is... there are no ideas in this. Any kind of like interesting, because like sci-fi is a it can be a great way to think about lot bigger ideas. You look at a movie like Blade Runner, where you can take this subject and like really go with it, and the idea here you know, about this guy who wants to bring his family back and use the technology to do that. That's an interesting idea. It's not like it's not been done before. You know, bringing dead people bringing dead people back is always a bad idea.
Yeah.
and you know, I mean, we got, you know, Pet Sematary. The remake of Pet Sematary is coming out in a couple of months, and that's essentially, you know, that's the whole core of what that's about. But none of that is explored in any way, and the science fiction itself in this movie is just stupid. You know, you know, because it's just like, you know, it's a genre that could be rich with ideas and like, if you know, you can, but there's nothing going on here. The you know, the acting is bad. The story is just stupid. You don't care about anything that's happening. And yeah, the you know, the whole subplot about the company and everything is just completely, you know, distracting and has nothing to do with what the core of the movie should be about. And you know, it's just stupid.
Yeah. It's like the movie like started off like it wanted to be like the brain that wouldn't die, you know, and they missed the opportunity to have Alice Eve's head just, you know, on a plate for an hour and a half. And then it ended like the reshoots of Brainstorm. I mean, it's just so stupid and pointless. And you know, I mean, like, I don't know where, you know, when this thing started production, where anyone thought this was going to go. Like, yeah, this is a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, well, it seems like it's a movie that you know, like, as we've said now a couple of times, that it's like it's one of those movies that should have just went straight to VOD. You know, there's just no question about it. It feels that way. You know, I'm in the theater going, why did I pay to see this? You know, what is this? This should have been on, you know, this should be on at like 2 o'clock in the morning on cable. I mean, it's
somebody
just,
had to know.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know where. I mean, it seems to me like a movie that's, it just feels like, and I don't know the history of this film or when it was shot or whatever, but it feels like a movie that sat on a shelf for a long time, and then Byron Allen dusted it off and released it in theaters.
It was on the schedule like sometime last year, I believe.
Yeah.
And then it got pulled from the schedule. I think it was supposed to come out in August, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it got pulled from the schedule, and then it just kind of like remained in limbo. And then I think I saw on Wikipedia that Entertainment Studios bought it in 2017. It like had some like special screening at Toronto or something like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't on the schedule for Toronto, I promise you that.
Yeah.
But somebody saw it and said, like, yeah, I'll put money into that.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's terrible. So.
Yeah.
All right, Eric, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress is with us. We've got a couple more movies to review. Jim is sick this week, but he'll be back next week, stepping in again for Colin, who's taken some time away. But Jim, it was too sick this morning to join us. When we get back, Eric and I will talk about a couple of more movies for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here, and coming up at 5 o'clock is Steve Grzanich with the opening bell, and 6 o'clock the great Steve Cochran for your morning drive, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right, Eric and I are handling the movies together this morning, talking about the new movies, and we'll also be talking about box office this week as well. Jim Liskowski is a little sick. He's under the weather, so he wasn't able to join us, but we are back, and we got a couple more movies to review, and then we will jump into the box office to tell you who were the winners and the losers at the box office this weekend. Let's welcome Eric back. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
All right, Eric, tell us about The Upside.
Okay, well, this is a remake of the French film The Intouchables from 2011, I believe the movie came out. Huge hit in France, still like one of their all-time grossing films. And this remake stars Kevin Hart as a guy that criminal who has a son and an ex-wife that he can't support anymore, and he's being for, you know, has to look for a job because for parole purposes, and he has to prove that he's looking for a job. Otherwise, you know, he's going to be in trouble again. So he goes through a number of places, basically, you know, trying to get a job, but just trying to get their signatures, and he goes to a large upscale residence, believing that he's going to be hired for cleaning services. But in fact, they're actually looking for someone to take care of a quadriplegic played by Bryan Cranston, a very rich quadriplegic. Nicole Kidman plays his business manager and basically his assistant. And when Kevin Hart interviews, or kind of interviews for the job, he doesn't really want it. But Bryan Cranston's character is very taken with him, and he also sees him as a possibility that things don't go right, as most likely they will not. He'd be the one person to either basically get him killed, as he kind of at the end of his ropes and wants to end his life. The very least will follow his orders to do not resuscitate him. But things don't quite go as planned, as the two basically kind of form a friendship through their time together, even though Kevin Hart is particularly bad at his job. But, he learns on the job, as you would hope someone taking care of someone in this situation, right? But their friendship develops. It's the movie of their relationship and, how it goes forward. Plot-wise, there's not a lot for me to say about this film, because even while I was watching it, it's a movie that didn't seem to have, any really stronger purpose than, just sort of documenting this relationship between the two of them, which is full of a number of cliches. The rich guy likes opera. Kevin Hart likes Aretha Franklin. That he's going to loosen him up by, giving him pot and, taking him out for strolls and stuff like that. And it's full of a lot of serious cliches. Nicole Kidman is kind of saddled with the third wheel role in here. I'll get back to her in a second. Watching the film, it's not that anyone is particularly bad in the film. I think Kevin Hart is fine in the film. I think Bryan Cranston is fine in the film. But it never really gives you, other than a couple early moments in the film, doesn't really give you that sort of sense of what it's really like to take care of someone in this situation. And so their relationship has kind of a sitcom feel to it throughout. This movie didn't quite get down to the level of The Bucket List for me, although it does fall into the category of movies that I like to call, boy, it's nice to have money. A lot of it, reminded me of the South Park episode where Magic Johnson reveals that he beat AIDS because he got, regular injections of cash. And that's what this movie kind of feels like, that, that it might not be so bad to be in this situation if you have a lot of money and you have a lot of people that want to be around you and you can throw your money around a bit. That message never really, works for me. One thing I will say, though, is that Nicole Kidman, who is really saddled with a third-rate role here, but does some really terrific stuff in the back half of this movie. There are a couple scenes in the movie where just with body language and smiles and the way she acts around Bryan Cranston's character, that really, particularly the final scene between the two of them, that made me so wish that there was no Kevin Hart in this movie, and that it was just a story about the two of them. There's a subplot involving him writing letters to a pen pal that they've never met, they've never spoken on the phone, and of course Kevin Hart throws a monkey wrench into that by just trying to get calling her against his will and trying to get them to hook up, and which leads to a very awkward scene. There's something that Nicole Kidman brings to a couple of these scenes late in the film that I just like, man, it would have been really interesting to see a real love affair break out between these two characters. I really wish the film had been about that, and not about this relationship that we've seen so many times before in different situations. I didn't hate the film, but I'm far from recommending it either.
Okay, hang on, Eric. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, I'll let you know what I thought of The Upside after we go to the news. And we'll be back after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios, right up here, 18 floors above beautiful downtown Chicago. Jim Liskowski is out sick, but Eric Childress is here, and he and I are handling all the movies, and we are going to talk about box office as well. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, I liked it more than you did. We're talking about The Upside, by the way. Bryan Cranston, Kevin Hart, Nicole Kidman movie. I liked it more than you did. I actually think that the relationship between the two of these guys, although, you know, like you said, it's not like it's anything new. We've seen this kind of thing a bunch of times before. But I thought both of them I think this is Kevin Hart's best performance, maybe, of any movie. Well, I don't know if that's saying much.
I wouldn't even disagree with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's Kevin Hart's most, you know, layered work.
Although there are two funny things in the movie, you know, considering what he's been going through lately.
Yeah.
There's a whole scene involving a catheter.
Yeah.
That is like, oh boy.
Yeah.
And there's another scene where he gives the "I'm just trying to make that a part of my past" speech.
Yeah.
It was like, oops.
Yeah, I know. It's a little, the timing on this is a little weird right now because of what he's going through. But I do, I mean, I also agree with you about Nicole Kidman. We're going to talk about Nicole Kidman in the next movie.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, yeah, we're going to talk about Nicole Kidman. A little bit different than what she does in this movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, this does cover a lot of cliched stuff that's been done before. But I think it's solid. I think it's entertaining. I think, you know, all the performances, are good. You know, the life lessons that we have here have been done a million times before. But, you know, like the dog movie, it goes through the paces that you expect. Mm-hmm. And it does so, I think, entertainingly. I thought it was an entertaining movie. And it made a good amount of money over the weekend, right?
Yeah, no, it's kind of surprisingly well. It's not a gigantic amount, but for what people expected it to do, I think it's a win for them.
Yeah, we'll go through the box office, but it unseated Aquaman as the number one movie in the country. But
yeah.
I think both of the main performances are really good. You know, Bryan Cranston, he's great, and you know he's always just mm-hmm. he's always good. Even when he was Tim Watley, he was good.
But work.
Exactly. But, you know, so I actually liked it. You're not going to see anything new. They didn't, you know, reinvent the wheel here or anything. It's been, you know, we've all seen these kind of things before, but it's sort of like comfort food. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're going to get. You know, like, people who went to see it over the weekend, you know, I think they went in thinking that they were going to get what they got, and they did. That's basically it.
I will admit, I mean, I kind of went into this with a little bit of that bucket list baggage that I have with that movie, because I think that movie is the most evil film ever made for the cash reasons that I refer to. So I kept waiting for moments that were going to elevate it, and it was the whole movie was kind of mostly on an even keel for me, where it didn't really, you know, rise or lower above a certain threshold. Although I will say there's one scene that really bothered me. If the scene wasn't in the movie, I would have probably been a little bit more, you know, pleasurable towards it. And anytime, whether it's real life or in movies, scenes that drive me nuts are moments where characters get so angry that they just wreck everything around them.
Yeah.
Because you never see the scene where they have to clean up everything.
Right.
Okay. And in this movie, you have a rich guy that can't move and gets so angry that he has Kevin Hart destroy everything for him.
Right.
That scene really angered me. That scene really bothered me, because he's throwing around a lot of rich stuff in that scene.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, that was the best they could come up with. That I don't know. That scene really rubbed me the wrong way.
It's ultimately it's played for a it's played for a laugh. You know,
laugh. It's hilarious.
Yeah,
it's hilarious.
Yeah, I didn't think it was hilarious, but it was. That's why it's in the movie. It's in the movie. So one purpose, and it's to get a cheap laugh. But
yeah.
All right. Well, I'm still I'm recommending it.
Okay.
So, all right, Eric. Tell us about speaking to Nicole Kidman. Tell us about Destroyer.
Okay. Well, this is the new film from Karen Kusama, and Nicole Kidman plays a police detective in the film, and as the film opens, she comes over to a crime scene. Body is dead in the reservoir. Movie set in Los Angeles?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, in the Los Angeles reservoir, and the cops see it thing as John Doe, but she claims that she can actually identify the body, and so she goes back to the department, and she actually receives a package containing a large dollar bill with what appears to be dye pack imposed on it. And she surmises that the leader of this gang of criminals is back on the streets, that he has resurfaced. And the movie then takes us through. She goes through different members, associates of his, trying to find out exactly where he is so she can bring him to justice. On top of that, we then flash back to a period in her life where we discover that she was actually undercover for some time, involving this criminal. She was a part of her gang. She had a fellow police detective played by Sebastian Stan, who was her partner and was also undercover with her. And they developed a relationship along the way under the stressful situation. And then the movie kind of goes back and forth between the past and the present, seeing exactly how all of these events are going to converge. Okay, so the convergence of everything that happens in this movie, to me, is actually kind of the least interesting aspect of it. I didn't feel that, because of the way the movie is structured, I didn't quite feel I didn't know if all of that worked. I didn't quite feel the necessary impact of as far as the plotting is concerned of this movie. However, the thing that does get you to feel everything in the movie is Nicole Kidman, she is the echelon. She is up there with the best of the best right now. And, this is a performance that, she's in the present scenes. She's very glammed down. I mean, there's a lot of makeup on her. I mean, she's basically halfway to where Charlize Theron was for Monster. I think that was almost kind of the look that they wanted to give her in a way, just maybe not without the weight aspect of that. And her performance in the movie is terrific. Is everything that she does in all aspects of the film, the present and the past, really kind of get you into where the story is going. The plotting and stuff didn't do much for me, but watching her navigate all the stuff and watching the choices that she is ultimately making that all eventually come together by the end of the movie does result in something that you can walk away from. And I don't think this is a great movie by any stretch. And I also gotta say that one of the gang members, or one of the criminals in the film, is played by Tatiana Maslany from Orphan Black. I didn't even know it was her until the end credits.
Yeah, no,
of the
too.
Movie.
Me too.
Yeah, I was just like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
So she's so watching their scenes together. When I watched it the second time, I was just like, man, you know, it's like two, you know, like the best actresses working today, doing their thing. I'm not going crazy over this movie. I'm going crazy over her performance, Kidman's performance, and Maslany's as well. I think other people will probably respond to the structure of the movie a bit more than I did. The reason to see this movie is Nicole Kidman.
Okay, hang on, okay, Eric?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric's going to hang on, and we'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Destroyer, Nicole Kidman's new film, right after we take this break. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and my main man, Steve Cochran, at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're going to talk about things that turn 50 this year so that we can all feel a little bit older. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on Facebook at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Jim Liskowski is sick, so Eric Childress and I are handling the movie reviews. And before the break, Eric told us all about the movie Destroyer with Nicole Kidman. And welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
Okay. I pretty much agree 100% with you. I don't think this is a great movie by any stretch of the imagination, but my God, Nicole Kidman is good in it. She's fantastic in it. It's a great performance. And again, everybody is talking about how, you know, physically she, you know, she's so transformed. Like when I first saw the trailer for this thing, I was like, what? You know?
Yeah.
She's one of the most glamorous women, you know, on the planet. And,
yes.
And to, you know, for the first time you see her in this movie, it's really shocking. But it's more than just, you know, she lives up to like everybody's like, oh, look how different she looks in this movie and how not beautiful and really, you know, transformative. But she, it's not just the look. It's not, because I'm not a fan of Charlize Theron in Monster. And I don't think there's much of a performance there besides, you know, how she transformed herself from being glamorous and not being glamorous. But Nicole Kidman does in this movie. She's there 100%. You know, it's not just the physical stuff. Like, dude, this is a really great performance. And there are a lot of scenes in this movie where she goes, you know, You know what I mean? there's a lot of shocking stuff in this movie. And, you know, you're unlikely to see an actress like Nicole Kidman do the kind of stuff that she does in this movie. And I didn't know it was her either. Tatiana Maslany, I didn't know it was her either.
Right.
I mean, but she's one of those. She's another one of those actresses that, like, you know, she really does. I mean, well, she, you know, in Orphan Black, she played 900 different roles,
yeah,
on that show. So she is one of those actresses that you can't recognize. She's really, seriously, like, I've seen her on talk shows, and I'm like, oh, that's what she looks like for real, because she's so, you know, physically different in everything that she does. And I didn't know. And like you, Eric, I was like, wait a minute, that was her.
Yeah,
I felt the same way. There's a lot. I think there's a lot of really, you know, like the flashback structure doesn't necessarily work. But what really knocks this thing out of the park 100% is, like you said, is Nicole Kidman. She's great. She's really, really great. And I'm recommending people see it just because of her. And I think, you know, I agree with you 100% on this. She's phenomenal in this movie. It's a great, it's a great performance.
Yeah, so I think that it's weird when, you know, just hearing us talk about it, that she's not more in the running for Best Actress.
Yeah, I know.
This year.
I know. It's crazy. I mean, she did get the Golden Globe nomination.
Right.
For Destroyer.
Right.
And
not much else.
No. And I think she's getting, and there's consideration for supporting actress for Boy Erased. I know that she was.
Yeah, like, that's not going to happen either.
Last night, the Critics' Choice Awards were given out, and she was nominated for that, but I don't see that happening either.
Okay.
But she's great in Destroyer. It's a great performance.
Yep.
All right, Eric, one more movie to talk about, and then box office. Tell us about Stan and Ollie.
Okay. Well, if the title doesn't clue you off, this is the story about Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy. The film that takes place basically at the end of their very, very long partnership. While the film opens with a bit telling us about how popular they were back in the 1930s and explain how Stan, played by Steve Coogan, got into payment disputes with Hal Roach and basically sort of dissolved their contract until Oliver had to go it alone, at least on one movie, and that has kind of not sit well with Stan for a couple of decades, even though he mostly keeps it to himself. Flash forward to the 1950s when Stan claims he is trying to get, the two of them are working together on an idea for a new comedic take on Robin Hood. So while they're working on that script, Stan keeps telling them that he's trying to get the funding for it, though it's run into more than a few snags. And while they do that, they're going to do some live stage shows in the United Kingdom and Ireland, basically try to boost their popularity, which doesn't go well at first, plays to a lot of empty houses. But as they begin making public appearances, the publicity pays off, and they start filling houses again with doing a lot of their old routines just on the live stage. But the issues with their partnership come to fruition at one point, and kind of fractures them off until they can get together again and everything is all happy and blah blah. Okay, so I was trying to think, even just now, if how many theatrical tales of Oliver and Stan and Ollie there have been over the years. Can you think of any other theatrical versions, Nick, where biopics
of Laurel and Hardy?
Yeah,
there was a TV movie. This is the only thing I can think of. There was a TV movie from, I want to say the 80s, and I can't remember who starred in it.
Yeah, that's the one I kept thinking of. So it's kind of remarkable that there's never been a story about these guys.
Yeah.
I'm probably not as much on my history with them as maybe you are, primarily because of all of the comedians of that era, and so all the ones that I studied and watched over and over again, they were always on the lower rung of the ones that I enjoyed. Every time I saw Laurel and Hardy films, I'd be like, that's kind of cute, but I'd never really developed this kind of rapport that I did with Chaplin and Keaton. Okay.
I'm just the opposite.
You're a big fan.
I love Laurel and Hardy. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So you probably have a little bit more invested in this movie than I did. Mm-hmm. And watching this movie, I kind of had the same reaction that I'm watching the routines. I'm like, that's cute. That's kind of nice. And one of the things that the best thing obviously about this movie are the two performances. Particularly, I think Steve Coogan, I didn't mention John C. Reilly plays Oliver Hardy.
Right.
But I think that Steve Coogan is particularly good as Laurel in the film. I think he gives the best. Riley's getting all the acclaim for, again, it's a lot of makeup to transform him into that. But I think Coogan does a lot more nuanced work as Laurel. But going back to how I originally set that up, this is a film that never really gets into why their popularity kind of waned. It goes from their highest point to their lowest point, but never really factors in. There's one shot where they, Stan passes a poster of Abbott and Costello, and we're supposed to go like, oh, the new kids on the block, that's why they're not popular anymore. But all the comedians, that I mentioned, I didn't even bring up W.C. Fields and everything, all these these widely popular characters from that time, the movie never really digs into that. And again, the partnership stuff in the film, I mean, we can go back to what we were just talking about, the upside is, you know, we've seen that kind of relationship, particularly in showbiz, play itself out exactly the way it plays out in this movie. And I felt that the film just kind of missed so many opportunities to grant further insight into just their comedy, just their, some of the better scenes of the movie are where I think they're actually working on the Robin Hood script and kind of like tossing ideas back and forth. I thought that, you know, those scenes were really kind of nice. The backstage showbiz stuff is just really not that interesting. And while the two of them play, are pros and play very well off each other, I just didn't feel anything beyond the way I used to watch Laurel and Hardy movies. Just like, yeah, that's kind of nice, but, you know, I'd rather go watch a better movie now.
Okay. All right, Eric, hang on. Eric Childress is going to hang on. We're going to take a break. Come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Stan and Ollie, and then we'll talk about the box office right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here on 18th floor here above downtown Chicago. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and Jim Liskowski is under the weather, so he is not joining us. So Eric Childress and I have been taking care of the movies, and before the break, Eric was telling you about Stan and Ollie. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, and I'll tell you what I thought of Stan and Ollie. I don't think it's a particularly good movie, and it's also not incredibly accurate in terms of what, you know, in terms of what they cover in this movie. So it's a pretty inaccurate study of what was happening. I thought it was an interesting idea to have the movie take place when it took place, like towards the end of their career.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was actually pretty cool, that the idea, the structure of it was that they were going to, this is towards the end of their partnership, and all the years that they worked together, that's part of the backstory of, you know, where they're going with it. And I thought it was kind of cool to have the movie told from that point of view, towards the end of their partnership, with a lot of years under their belts and stuff. But it, like I said, it's not very historically accurate. And again, you know, as you've said, Eric, it kind of covers the same kind of territory that you see in your basic sort of biopics about, you know, stars and their lives. So there's nothing really new here. But the two performances are great. I think John C. Reilly is great, and as you said, Steve Coogan is incredible in it. And they recreate the bits that Laurel and Hardy do perfectly. So they clearly did their homework here. And it's not just them recreating the bits that Laurel and Hardy did, but there's a real sense of chemistry between the two of them. Like, they really work well together. And they're both terrific actors. And so for me, I'm not necessarily recommending the movie, but man, they're both so good in it. I mean, it's just terrific performances from both of them. Danny Houston is going to play. Does he play villains all the time now? Is that like? And that's another thing. Like Hal Roach is really comes off as a jerk. In this movie, and I'm not really. Yeah. I know that it's kind of one. It's kind of one sided in terms of what the point of view that this movie has. But,
yeah.
You know, but Danny Houston, I can't remember the last time Danny Houston didn't play a jerk. Was he a jerk? He was even a jerk in Children of Men, too. All the way back to that.
And if they would have followed the book, it would have been even more of a jerk.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
That's going to keep me up all night now, thinking about Danny Houston.
Danny Houston. Anyway, but I will say this. I mean, it's not a great movie by any stretch of the imagination, but both of these guys are great in it. I think John C. Reilly and Steve Coogan, tremendous, and they really do a good job. They bring a humanity to it. There's a great chemistry between the two of them. You can feel the history between them, and then on top of it, they really nail the routines that they do. Like, they really, you know, you could tell these guys really cared about these performances, and they did their homework, and it shows, because they're both really terrific in it. But I can't really go out of my way to recommend the movie. So
yeah, it seems to be a trend this week. A lot of really great performances movies that we're kind of on the fence about.
Exactly. All right, let's go through the box office, shall we?
Yeah.
All right. Number one movie of the week is The Upside with $19.5 million. Again, we talked a little bit earlier about that that outperformed what we thought it was going to do, right?
Yeah, no, I think everyone, including myself, had figured Aquaman was in for the fourth week, number one in a row.
Yeah.
And, I think, this movie, because what we didn't mention is that this movie actually premiered at the Toronto Film Festival in 2017.
Right.
When it was handled by a little company run by Harvey Weinstein.
Right, right.
And so, like, a month after it premiered, all of that erupted, and they had to sell off all their movies, or shelve them, at least. And this was picked up by STX, and I don't think anyone had any great expectations for it. But I think that this you have to say that this is part of the star power of Kevin Hart.
Yeah.
Because he was able to even with the troubles that he's been going to, maybe this is a reaction to that on top of it, that people went out to support him in some way. I don't think in a movie that it's kind of advertised as a comedy a little bit, but certainly not Wedding Ringer or Ride Along.
No. I mean,
Kevin Hart helps the quadruped. Is not exactly ripe for huge chuckles.
Oh yeah. I mean, he's not getting kicked in the nuts by Tiffany Haddish. That's what I mean.
Right.
Like, that's the kind of stuff that you would normally expect.
Right.
In a Kevin Hart movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that Bryan Cranston adds a lot of a lot of weight to it. You know what I mean? Like, if you're Kevin Hart's in a movie with Bryan Cranston, it's like, oh, wait a minute.
Right.
Because normally he's with The Rock or, somebody like that. but this is like an actor, like a guy who's like on Broadway right now playing, Peter Finch's role in Network, and getting amazing acclaim for it. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but that's it. And of course, Nicole Kidman, too. So you got Nicole Kidman, you got Bryan Cranston, and then Kevin Hart.
Yeah.
So that adds a lot of,
That almost makes you think that the grosses would go down because people were just like, Kevin Hart's trying to be serious now.
Right.
Well, we want him as the short. The funniest scene in the movie to me is the first scene between Nicole Kidman and Kevin Hart.
Mm-hmm.
Just seeing how they tried to make him seem not as short.
Yeah.
That was funny to me.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Well, Aquaman, $17.2 million. That's up to $287 million in America. What's it doing world? It's at a billion worldwide already.
It has crossed the $1 billion mark.
My God.
It is the first film in the current DC cinematic universe to reach $1 billion.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's now up there. I mean, the Nolan's Dark Knight movies are not considered part of this universe, obviously, because they have a new Batman. But this is the first DC property. I mean, Wonder Woman did not reach $1 billion. Huge numbers here, but it was only kind of matched internationally.
Yeah.
Aquaman, $1 billion. 37th film ever to cross the $1 billion mark worldwide.
Wow, that's ridiculous. Because it sucks. Number three, A Dog's Way Home, $11.3 million. I can tell you the crowd that I saw it with on Saturday loved it.
This is kind of right in the wheelhouse of live action, animal films.
Right.
Not huge, not short. It'll probably it'll have a decent kind of hold kind of thing, but is not going to set the world on fire.
Right. Okay. Number four, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. $9 million up to $147.7 million, and this is doing well considering, right?
Oh yeah, no, I mean the holds on this movie. I mean, the word of mouth just keeps building on this thing. This movie is going to be headed somewhere in the $180 million range in the U.S., which is peanuts compared to obviously other movies like Aquaman and other movies in the Marvel universe. But for an animated Spider-Man film that not a lot of people have put a lot of stock in early on, present company included.
Yeah.
You cannot discount these numbers. They're very good.
Yeah. Number five, Escape Room, $8.9 million, $32.4 million total. So the new Saw movie is now called Escape. Escape Room.
That's right.
Because that's essentially
welcome to the new franchise. they cranked this thing out for like $9 million, and they went the full Blumhouse on it.
Yep.
And this thing's probably gonna it's gonna get over close to around $50 million.
Wow.
So that's a hit.
Yep. And it's not called Saw, but it is.
Yeah.
Number six, Mary Poppins Returns, $7.2 million. This is, to me, seems like it's underperforming, right?
It is. Yeah, I mean, it was steady all through the holidays, and it was, you know, I predicted, I thought this was going to be the biggest movie of the holiday. I really thought that this movie was going to just, you know, bridge all kinds of generations.
Yeah.
And, you know, Aquaman, I think, took a bit out of that.
Yeah.
To say the least. But it had been holding very steadily, you know, throughout the holidays, and it took a much bigger drop this week than I expected it to. I mean, now it looks like Spider-Man is going to make more than Mary Poppins.
Isn't that crazy?
And it's curious, you know, just this weekend that Disney apparently had people dropping the news that they want to do more Mary Poppins movies.
Really?
And yeah, and I'm just like, you better get this one into profit first there, Disney.
Yeah.
Because you're not there yet. You still need about another $100 million for this movie to get into profit. And I don't know if it's open everywhere overseas yet, but it's not there yet. And now it looks like it's probably not going to do $200 million here in the U.S.
That's crazy. I never would have expected that. Really,
no.
Seriously. Number seven, Bumblebee, $6.7 million, $108 million. As far as Transformers movies go, this is underperforming, right?
Oh, big time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that stupid Last Night movie with Mark Wahlberg, the last Transformers, the last Michael Bay one, that did $600 million worldwide.
Oh, my God.
This one's at around, like, 368, I think, is what it's at.
Mm.
And yet, funny enough, the best-reviewed Transformers movie...
Yeah, no question.
It has a higher Rotten Tomato score than the last four Transformers movies combined.
Right. And yet, no one's going to see it.
Right.
Number eight, On the Basis of Sex, $6.2 million, $10 million total. That's about expected, correct?
Yeah, a good jump for where they expanded this thing. You can't turn on the news, Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Well, yeah.
Somewhere in the news somewhere.
Yeah.
These days, so she's getting free publicity just for, you know, being herself.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's decent. It's not going to, you know, make any awards dents in the next couple of weeks. Yeah. But you know, people will, you know, still go see it.
Number nine, The Mule, $5.5 million, $90 million for this movie, man.
Yeah, and it's gonna cross the $100 million mark.
Is that crazy? It'll
be the sixth film of Eastwood's career as a director to reach the $100 million mark.
That's amazing. I gotta say, it's amazing. I don't know.
Yeah.
Number 10 is Vice, $3.2 million, $35.9 million total. And is that that's not fully released, right? I mean, it's.
Oh yeah, no, it's been fully released.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Oh yeah, no, it's been, since Christmas. It's been out in wide release.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of. I mean, it's going to get a little bit of a awards bump in a couple of weeks.
Right.
But it's just about, you know, it'll be out of the top 10 next week, obviously, when Glass opens.
Right.
But that's kind of what I expected it to do. I didn't, you know, think that, you know, whatever the reviews are going to be on it, just I don't think people want to see a lot of movies about politics.
Yeah.
Right now. And I think that the reason this one did as well as it has is because of the cast, obviously.
Yeah, clearly. All right. Well, there you go. Those are your top 10. Next week, obviously, Glass is going to be number one.
Glass is going to be huge. It's going to be huge. The Universal let the embargo drop on it earlier this week, and even the people who are normally have been a little soft on Shyamalan during this resurgence that he's had, they are not pleased with the film.
Yeah, no, I mean, it just looks terrible, but well, we'll see. So that's the big one next week. And
yeah.
And well, all right, Eric, thanks, man. And we will talk
sure
to you
thing.
Next week, and we'll get Jim in here. He'll be up and ready to go next week.
Yes, he will.
All right, Eric, thanks, buddy.
Sounds good.
All right, there you go. Eric Childress will be back next week. Jim Liskowski will be back next week for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, and we'll do it all again then. All right, we'll take a quick break here on 720 WGN.